Talk given Friday, 13th July, 1973. Let me start first by quoting something from Tibetan Yoga and Secret Doctrines by Evans Wentz. This is in connection with the training of the mind. And this is the passage. In employing another method of concentrating the mind, namely that in which no object of concentration is used, there are three processes. The instantaneous cutting off of a thought at the root, the very moment it arises, as if in a flash, leaving unshaped whatever concept or idea appears, and letting the mind assume its natural condition of absolute quiescence, unmoved by the disturbing process of thought. It's a tall order. But let us try and go into it in a manner similar to the manner in which we carried out our last meeting, as a meditative process. So, let the body be perfectly at ease, comfortably balanced, and let the head be perfectly poised on the neck. No muscular tensions anywhere. Feel the abdominal region at ease, the pelvic region. And let the rhythm of the breath establish itself quietly. Now just be aware of that rhythm of the breath as the physical expression of the rhythm of the entire life process within oneself, physical, psychological, and spiritual. Your own particular, unique life rhythm. Let it be in harmony within your own being and with the life rhythm which is universal. Just let that be established, and we'll take a minute or two over it. Now let the mind quietly dwell upon the fact that if that life rhythm is perfectly established within oneself, then there is no intrusion of thoughts and feelings which are reactions to external stimuli or to memories that rise up from within. In other words, one's whole being is in a perfectly harmonious state, in the same sort of harmonious state as the one into which one enters in profound slumber, dreamless slumber, with this difference that here you enter into that harmony, that perfect harmony, whilst you are awake and not asleep. Just let the mind, consciousness itself, feel that. Let its peace permeate the whole body, the whole psychophysical organism. So that the turmoil and violence of the impacts of the world cease to shake your natural state of poise. Just keep the breath rhythm going quietly. But you will find that thoughts will intrude. The brain does not stop chattering. A continuous flow of words expressing discursive thought. Don't attempt to stop it. That only produces a state of conflict. Just observe the thoughts. Let them pass by, as if you were on the banks watching the stream flow past. Just let the breath rhythm go on undisturbed. Now we can go through a useful exercise. Take any particular thought that springs up right now and hold it in the mind. Observe for yourself to which sense impression it is closely related. It might be the impression of a sight, or a sound, a taste, or a touch, or whatever it is. Or it may be more than one type of sense impression. But look carefully at the principal sense impressions which are involved in that thought. Now just look at that very carefully for a few moments. Now look carefully at the particular sense impression which is involved. Usually it will be the impression of sight, because that is the most powerful sense on the whole in most people. It's a sight impression which supplies the substance of that particular thought. And looking at that sense impression, let us say, for example, the sight impression, observe how it is conditioned. A 100 people might see any one thing or event, and they will all have a different, slightly different, or maybe considerably different account of it. Now notice just exactly what is your own account of that sight impression. And see if you can relate it to the conditioning influences at play, the judgments passed upon the sight. This is a pleasant sight, this is an unpleasant sight, this is exciting, etc., etc. And see to what extent you can relate them to your own characteristics, your own nature, as far as you are aware of it. You will find that your weaknesses or strengths, your indifference or real poise, your attachments and aversions are all involved in the conditioning of this sight impression. Note for yourself the predominant ones. And note how they affect your state of ease or your state of upset. Your pain and sorrow or your pleasure and excited joy. Note it very carefully. But note it all dispassionately. Don't say, this is evil or bad, I must get rid of it. Nor, on the other hand, say, this is good, I must treasure it and cultivate it. Just observe it very carefully and observe it very sensitively. The warmth aspect of the mind, which we call the heart, usually in religious terms. The warmth aspect, as well as the perfectly cool intellectual observation. And you may find that if the quality of your observing process is the right quality, you will observe in a state of real poise within yourself. And in that state of observation, the binding elements in connection with that particular sense function, the sight impression, will fall away. Because then one sees the fact as it is, and not as one imagined it was. And this brings us very much to the heart of the matter. Now listen carefully. All our sense impressions are pictures in our mind. The mind in all of us as we are is an image building agent. It makes images. And these images are always partly or very considerably false images. They are not the truth of that which is conveyed by the sense of sight. The senses receive the impressions through that sensitivity in us which we may call pure awareness. What is received through pure awareness is never an image. It is a living reality in the living act of reception by one's senses. But because we are ignorant, we are conditioned, we are influenced, and so forth, the mind, the brain particularly, stores up those impressions, or to put it in other terms, we are conscious of what we are aware of. We are conscious of it as deceptive images. This is a point of very, very great importance. This is the crux of the matter. This is why we go wrong, as we say, all along the line. we are deluded. Recall the Buddha's extraordinary statement, which few people ever really understand. After the Enlightenment, he talks of himself, amongst other things, as a being not liable to delusion. And because he is not liable to delusion, the terrible burden of unnecessary sorrow of the whole of the past drops off. And also, he has altogether ceased to be a producer of ill in any shape or form. The secret is in the mind. The secret is to become free of the way we are conscious of this image-building activity, image-producing activity, which veils the actual truth of that which comes to us through the functioning of the senses. I hope this can help us to see why it is such a great mistake to decry the senses, to suppress or fight against the senses. Without the senses, we are senseless. Totally senseless. We are senseless enough even with our senses. You may recall that phrase we have used sometimes. The senses and the operation of the senses are our real cords of communion with the total reality. And this means that if we are in that state, our senses are being used perfectly, which means that we live truthfully all the time, truthfully in the human context. This purification, this pure use of the senses, is one of the deep meanings of yoga. We are all acquainted with the use of physical postures and various exercises and so forth, which we call yoga. All that is a fraction of the whole thing. That's the kindergarten part of the business. It can bear repetition over and over again. The physical exercises part is so to discipline the body, not compel it, to discipline it. That means to let it learn. To let it learn, not to intrude upon the process of communion, continuous communion. This is the purpose of the physical aspect of yoga, the postures and so on. Not to let it intrude. Now you can relate this to the next stage, which is called pratyahara, which is usually translated as the withdrawal of the senses from the objects of sense. If you do that, you can't live in the world. Look at it this way. Pratyahara means freeing oneself from all attachment and aversion involved in the activity of the senses. That is the withdrawal. You free yourself from attachment and aversion. Consider carefully that in the great disciplines, as taught by the great teachers themselves, the real yogis, and the perfected holy ones, one of the essential aspects was the training of the senses to function perfectly. The eyes are meant to see with, the ears to hear with. And how is the disciple trained to see? To see everything completely, perfectly. Like a scientist in a laboratory or wherever, whatever activity he's engaged in, will observe in complete detail, seeing the thing as a whole, seeing the separate parts, and the relationship of those parts amongst themselves and to the whole. That is how you train your sense of sight. And if at the same time you remain mindful, sensible in the real sense, in other words, and remain free of attachment and aversion to what you're seeing, then you see truth. You see truly, not conditioned by one's own bias or prejudice, or by one's preconception or assumption. See what this means? You see the importance of the senses. So to fight against the senses, to repress them or suppress them, or to run away from what the senses convey, is the very way to be irreligious. Because then one is rejecting the world. Am I not insulting transcendence itself in rejecting that which transcendence has brought into being, and which is the actual body, the living body of transcendence itself? This is my body, eat of it, said a great teacher. This is my blood, drink of it, said that same teacher. And what is it that we eat and drink? That which sustains us. And the body and blood of the perfected one is the totality of existence, of manifestation. That is the body and blood of the Holy One. You see, And it is then that one releases the natural faculty of being free of this unhappy flow of discursive thinking which plagues our lives. Because this thought and its verbal formulation is nothing but the imposition of my image-making faculty upon reality. I am making reality, or trying to make reality, unreal. See? So then that discursive process comes to its natural ending. Now we must be careful here. This does not in the least mean that we will stop talking altogether, or that the brain activity which gives rise to the stream of thought will stop. Not at all. It has its place in manifestation, in our everyday existence. But consider carefully. It has its place, its right place, only when it is truly pure and free. When the senses and the brain are no longer the slaves of desire, of all our conditioning, of all those drives which come out of what we may call our animal nature, with no disrespect to the animal, but we have to be different from the animal. When that is the case, there is no intrusion of desire, which is always self-oriented, which is against the wholeness of existence, all self-orientation is, when that happens, this useless chattering in the brain, this stream of inconsequential, absurd, childish, often violent, wicked, malicious, evil, discursive thinking stops. You are free of it. You, for the first time then, begin to breathe the air of heaven. Because the realm of the mind is the realm of heaven. The pure mind, the realm of the impure mind, is hell. This is heaven and hell. And it lies within our own power to bring about the right condition. If we try to bring about heaven desirously, if we try to get rid of hell desirously, that will be the very way to perpetuate the conflict of heaven and hell within us. No, the freedom from desire. And why is the freedom from desire so very, very important? One can never overemphasize its importance. Because the reality in its natural condition is the perfect thing. It doesn't need my desire and my striving for it. All my desiring and striving is an obstruction to its natural condition. I must just be awake in the right manner. That is to say, to see that I am not a blot upon the universe. I am not an obstructor of the free flow of life in its transcendence, which is its natural and perfect state. Now, this is very important. And this free flow of life is related, is tied up with the free flow of the life rhythm in your whole being, the total life rhythm, the spiritual, psychological, physical, and its physical roots consists of the breath rhythm. It is a well-known fact. It has been known through the ages. Every doctor, anybody knows it, that according to your emotions, your thoughts, your breath rhythm alters. You get excited, you have one sort of breath rhythm. You get angry, you have another. So if you are in a state of terrible fear, you have another breath rhythm. But in the state, in your natural state, as the pure human, your breath rhythm is perfectly harmonious. It's in tune, it's in with the whole universe. One doesn't need to examine it. In fact, you can't examine it and say, now is my breath rhythm in tune with the universal life rhythm? Of course, that is a foolish question. A foolish pursuit. You can't do it. Let it be. It's all right. This is our great difficulty, isn't it? To let it be. You see why I have said over and over again, live by letting live, not live and let live, in this sort of slightly acidy. Put on tolerance. No. I cannot tolerate the universe, nor does the universe tolerate or try to tolerate me. The universe and oneself are absolute realities. The unabandonable fact. And it is because of this unabandonable fact, the word I, which we use night and day and every day of our lives constantly, has tremendous meaning, has total meaning in the context of totality, the one total reality. The word I means the one total reality. And when that permeates one's own awareness, not merely the consciousness, which is conscious of all the images that have been stored up in the well of the subconscious mind, when one's whole awareness is permeated that way, then there is no selfness whatsoever involved in the word I. In fact, you, speaking, functioning, thinking, as the first person, are speaking like that and are able to speak like that because the isolated self is absent. The total self is there. Now, there is the state of necessity, the state of peace. In the midst of any circumstance, whatever it may be, It is the state of nirvana, really. It is the kingdom of heaven here and now. Jesus on the cross, suffering the supreme agony, fully manifested the kingdom of heaven itself. It's a strange thing to say. But consider how St. John puts the last words of Jesus. These words are only in St. John's Gospel. It is finished, perfected, consummated. Not finished in the sense that now the play at the theatre has come to an end. It's not that. It is finished. What was the it that he was talking of? The great purpose for which there was that manifestation in the world which we know as Jesus Christ. And the purpose was that the perfect expression of thy will, not mine, should come to full fruition, and it did. It is finished, perfected. Now, in that state, do you think that there was any stream of discursive thought in his mind? None at all. Do you think there was any necessity for him to struggle against, to fight against the forces of evil or whatever they were? Not at all. See, the holy ones take the totality of evil, as we understand it, into their own being. And this evil of the world, in the world process, continuously flows into them all the time. It is transmuted, and only beneficence flows out. This is the meaning of living the holy life. But if I, the individual, am full of all these petty little thoughts and feelings, most of them absurd and stupid, and a good many of them evil, if they are there, how can I fulfill the purpose for which? How can the purpose for which I was brought into existence by the universe be fulfilled? Can't be done. So you see, when you practice this, watch the thought process. Don't fight against it. Just observe in the manner in which we tried to do this evening. Just observe the sense impressions and the part played by those sense impressions. Don't fight against them. If I don't like my nose, I'm not a wise fellow if I smash it. I'll be uglier than ever. So, with love and wisdom, be in the state of meditation constantly.